This week on Lunchbox Envy. In medieval Europe, it was believed some of them grew from seeds.
The oldest known recipe is written in the ancient language of cuneiform.
And according to scientists, they're cleverer than alpacas, but stupider than goats.
It's lamb! Hello, and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu, and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Manu.
And chef and food writer, Rosie.
Good afternoon.
We're lambing it up.
Yeah, today. Where do you think you rank? Cleverer than an alpaca?
Oh, right now I'd go at the bottom of, just slightly under alpaca.
I'm a big fan of lamb, me.
Oh, me too.
It's not my most consumed meat,
okay. But
I would say it is one of my, if not my favourite. I just think it is delicious. Mm-hmm. When I left my chef job in the restaurant that I worked in, there was a tradition in the kitchen to make a special star food for the leaving chef.
Mm-hmm.
And the team made me lamb burgers.
Ooh.
And then they made a hollandaise sauce made from lamb fat.
Wow.
Wow.
It was rich, to say the least.
That sounds a bit last mealy.
Yeah, it was
like
quite
going
last
to the
mealy.
Electric chair?
Yeah. Yeah.
So good.
And then after that, they threw loads of flour and eggs and stuff on me, because that's the other thing that you do to a chef who's leaving.
And then deep fried you.
Yeah. So I was like, cool, I'm covered in gross stuff and I have to go to the pub.
I agree. I think it's got a special... It's not too ubiquitous. I find chicken, especially if it's cheap, goes in a lot of curries and seems to be fine to stir fry or make burgers from.
Mm.
And even beef is a bit more neutral tasting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make it work. You can make it sing. You can try different cuts as well. But lamb actually has quite a distinctive taste.
Mm.
And it's also common to most cuisines because Jewish people can eat it, Hindus can eat it, Muslims can eat it.
And sheep, notoriously easy to rear.
Mm.
In
Absolutely.
Theory.
Or are they?
Or are they? Oh, Rosie likes to set herself up for something that's going to be disproved.
Speaking from personal experience on this one, because I used to rear sheep.
Did you?
Yeah,
what?
I did. When I was a teenager in the countryside.
No way. Was this part of your homeschooling?
It was actually part of my homeschooling.
Wow. Love it.
They bought me a few sheep. And now I know a bit too much about sheep.
Yeah. Have you birthed?
I was going to ask.
Lamb?
Yeah,
not yourself personally.
No, I did go on a lambing course.
Okay,
in which I had to pull a dead frozen lamb through the pelvis bones of a sheep.
Oh, what?
Oh, my God, like, that is grotesque.
No, but like, it was the sheep's pelvis bones were removed from the rest of the carcass.
Yeah, so it was literally just like a fake.
Okay, right.
I mean, like a real pelvis of a dead sheep bones. And then you were like, they kept the dead lambs from the lambing season year before.
Jesus.
Chucked them in the freezer.
So it was like a simulation.
Yeah, and then thawed them out. So they were quite wibbly wobbly and really cold. And you had to like pull them through the hole in a specific way. And
how did it go? Did you do it? Did you pass?
I mean,
the lambing exam.
It survived. It was already dead.
I've seen some lambs being born myself because my uncle still does actually. He used to rear sheep in his old farm in Ireland, it's pretty gory.
Mm-hmm. It is gory indeed. It was cute though when they're all out and they're fluffy.
And that was the thing when. There was a lamb whose maybe their mum died or maybe they weren't doing so well. My uncle and aunt would bring them into the house and they would keep them in the bottom oven of the Arga because that was the warming oven and it was really warm in there but not hot enough to cook them.
Oh, wow.
With the door open, obviously, so for oxygen.
Yeah,
but you'd like walk past the Arga. Sorry, this is the most British thing ever, even though it was Ireland. But and you'd see a lamb's like feet sticking out and you'd be like, oh, hell, look, you got a lamb in, have you?
Oh, so cute. There's a term for this. So there's a glossary on the National Sheep Association website.
Okay.
Cage lamb.
Oh, okay.
An orphaned lamb that's been rejected by its mother or its parents have died. So they're called poddy lambs or pet lambs or cage lambs.
Sweetie boys, I call them.
I know, they're so cute. There's loads of really good terms. There's one that I came across that I'd forgotten, like pushed out of my memory from having sheep, but it's called dagging.
Dagging.
Is it like sex? Is it like the killing of another sheep with your...
Horns.
Horns.
Okay. No,
I don't know.
The other end of the sheep.
Is it
butt end?
Is the butt end.
Pooing.
So dags are the piece of dried poo that hang off the butt of a sheep.
Oh my God. Iconic. They are literally what I think of when I think of sheep.
But that's why you kind of dock their tails, because sheep have actually really long tails. Yeah, yeah. And then you put the rubber bands on them so that you don't get loads of dags, which are the dried poopy bits. And then dagging is to cut the poopy bits off the sheep.
Got it.
Yeah.
God. And then put them in your stew.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the other side of the birthing process, in the redding?
In the redding? Oh, is that the sexy bit?
The sexy bit, yes. It's when you paint a ram's front so that when it mounts a ewe, she gets red on her back. So you can tell which ewes have been inseminated.
So you have a harness that you clip around the ram, and it's got a giant crayon on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can tell, like Jack said, which sheep have been getting it on, which ones have blue or bright pink or orange butts.
This is genius, actually.
Yeah, it's true. So
there's also a whole lexicon of words that I didn't know were used in lamb sheep farming.
Used.
Use.
That's terrible.
E-W-E-S-E-D.
Oh, I get it. She was like, wait, is it stopped?
There are loads of different terms for very similar processes in sheep rearing. And this is because we've been doing it for a really, really long time. So we've been eating lamb for at least 11,000 years.
Wow.
So think they were domesticated along the Fertile Crescent. Mm-hmm. From around 10,000 to 8,000 BCE, so before Common Era.
Where is the Fertile Crescent?
So it spans quite a few countries, including Iraq, Iran, Turkey. Some say it stretches to Cyprus. It's a big swathe of countries around the area.
Okay.
It's if you're looking at the map, north-south, it's an upside-down boomerang that stretches from the Nile Delta around some of the desert that's in the way and ends in, Iraq with the Mesopotamia.
Mm.
It's basically where agriculture started, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We think. But yeah, so it's got a long history.
Mm-hmm. A really long history, because they're incredibly useful animals. Mm. So they're tasty, as we have established. They are really good at clearing land for farming because they eat so many different kinds of plants.
Yeah.
They produce milk, which is very handy. And they produce insulation, as in they're woolly, which is fantastic.
Mm.
And they make oil. So they've got a waterproof coating on their wool, which is called lanolin, and we still use this in loads of different products.
It's in everything.
Literally everything.
Wow.
It's really shit if you've got a lanolin allergy.
Oh, I never thought about that.
Yeah, you can't wear condoms.
Is it
really?
A condom?
Yeah, some condoms.
Yeah. Goodness.
Wait, didn't they use sheep intestines for really early condoms?
I think they might have done, yeah.
Oh. I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a very multifunctional animal.
Sheep are the original cottage core. Wearing their Gore-Tec.
Yeah.
And their Salomons.
Slippery. Waterproof. But yeah, it's one of the recent uses I found for lanolin, which I love, was in balm for chapped nipples. Not just lip
balm. Yeah, balm for chapped nipples.
When I was breastfeeding, my nipple cream was lanolin based.
Was it good?
It was fantastic.
Nice. Thank
it
you.
It saved me.
Next time, just rub a sheep.
Oh, God. They're smelly.
And they're also pretty stupid.
I was looking a little bit at sheep intelligence because that was apart from the dagging, my strongest memory of having sheep for a bit was they are flipping idiots.
I suppose it's kind of a hard thing and not very fair of me to say an animal is stupid when I don't know what, relatively speaking, stupidity is to an animal, if you know what I mean.
It's hard to pin
they're
down.
Animals.
If you judge, was it Einstein? Or this might have been misattributed to Einstein, but he said if you judge a goldfish by its ability to climb a tree, it'll spend its life thinking it's stupid.
No.
And I do think there is, not to get too philosophical, but we don't know what's going on in a lamb's head. It might be having really deep philosophical thoughts.
They might be having really intense conversations with each other.
Mm. I mean, they do. They have a really wide range of vocalizations, and they're great at communicating with their, not kids because that's goats, but their little ones.
They're young.
There was research that kind of ranked goats, sheep and alpacas against each other. And goats are actually wildly intelligent.
Really?
And sheep are kind of they are really cool. They can do a lot of different things. Like they have really good facial memory, so they can look at different faces and different orientations in human faces and recognize them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So if you were a sheep farmer, your sheep could in theory recognize you?
Yes.
Right, okay. Oh.
So when it comes to eating sheep, we, in this country at least, never really call it sheep. We've got lots of different euphemisms and different vocab for it.
That's very true. I mean, this also comes from, we've spoken about the kind of Normandy takeover of
what, William the Conqueror?
Normandy resident.
1066.
Yeah.
The Bayeux Tapestry.
Well done.
I've been listening to history podcasts recently. Thank you.
But yeah, that exact distinction between the upper classes eating the meat and the lower classes rearing them, which is why we have like mutton, mouton. Yeah. But the species we're going to talk about is Ovis aries.
I'm an Aries.
There we go.
Right.
So we're also going to be talking about different types of meat, which is kind of split into ages.
Yeah. Mm. I've brought you a sample of each.
Oh my God.
Maybe that's just
heaven.
Yeah.
Can I can I just ask a quick question? Mm-hmm. Did either of you, are either of you au fait with the Catholic faith?
mildly. My father was a devout Catholic.
I was at Catholic school my whole life. And so often when I think of lamb, what I think of is Lamb of God, which is another name in the New Testament and in Catholicism for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We used to sing songs about the Lamb of God. And then in the Catholic Mass, there's like a long section of like, Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world, have mercy on us. And all this stuff. It's a really like nostalgic thing for me. It's a really strong association. And I know the Latin is Agnus Dei, which is like Lamb of God.
So I did my cheat code and I emailed Ken Albala, who's been on the podcast before and does a lot on like medieval and religious history and food. I basically asked like, what is happening with this Lamb of God malarkey? And he said it's got something to do with the fact that God loves the smell of a barbecue.
This is a hot take.
Say again.
So in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, there's quite a lot written about sacrificing animals and burning them, particularly the fat, to create lovely smells for God to enjoy. And part of that kind of ritual sacrifice and the scapegoat and the...
This just sounds like such a hilarious excuse to eat meat. I actually just really wanted to smell it.
Yeah.
And I wanted God to smell it. And it just so happened that we needed to eat it after it was cooked. So I ate it.
Yeah, waste not, one.
So yeah, it's in Numbers 29:2. I don't know how to read these bits properly.
My favourite Bible passage, because you always say numbers and then you read out two numbers.
It basically, there's a section that commands the Israelites to sacrifice and burn meat during the Feast of the Trumpets. And it says, because an aroma pleasing to the Lord, offer a burnt offering of one young bull, one ram, and seven male lambs a year old, all without defect. And apparently the smell...
No dags on your lambs.
Absolutely no dags. The smell was supposed to please God and then he'd forgive you all of your sins and the sins would be taken by the lamb. And that idea of kind of like sacrifice and atonement via these animals is kind of what gets kind of imprinted onto the crucifixion of Jesus.
Of course,
God of Lamb.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Lamb of God.
Seems common to many religions, you know, like even the Aztecs were into sacrifice, obviously, in a human way. But maybe there's something intrinsically human about the idea of sacrificing a living thing to please the gods.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting how lamb... the sacrificial lamb is now used as a term for anything or anyone that, you know, similarly, scapegoat. It's slightly different.
But which one would you rather be?
The goat.
I'd rather be the goat.
Really? Oh, but you'd be so lonely.
I'd rather be the lamb. You get revered for the rest of history.
Yeah, but you'd also get killed and eaten.
No, but in order to save other people, it's noble. It's like the Gryffindor of the Bible.
Oh, you loser. I'm a Slytherin. I want to be a scapegoat. I'm off. I'm going to live my
You're
life.
You're already tainted.
So it's time for our first lunchbox, and today that is yours, Jack.
There is Alex, the producer's cat, Raymond. He's trying to jump on the table and eat our lunchbox.
This is definitely his favourite episode.
Oh, for sure.
I have brought three almost identical chops of lamb, mm-hmm. except only one of them is lamb.
Ooh.
The other two are hogget and mutton. And I thought we'd do a taste test. So there are no hard and fast rules, but generally lamb is less than a year old mm-hmm. At time of slaughter. Mm-hmm. And then mutton is old.
Mm-hmm. I've got 2+ years.
Two plus years, yeah. And then hogget is what's in between. So it's kind of like mm-hmm. a teenager. So anything between 1 and 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And mutton is not very popular in this country anymore.
No.
We tend to eat lamb. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably for commercial reasons more than taste, although they do taste different. And I wondered whether we should try, because I know which order they're in.
Mm. Well, also, I was always told, before I did formal chef training, that mutton was tough and dry, and because it was older, and basically that the sheep just don't taste as good the older they get. That when actually mutton is quite delicious if it cooked correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the reason it's in decline is because we don't have a particularly viable and large wool industry anymore.
Mm.
So back in the day, you'd raise a sheep, you'd shear it and get loads of like harvests of wool, and then once it was about to die, you'd kill it and cook it in a stew,
mm-hmm.
and that would be many years old. Whereas now it's not really commercially worth keeping a lamb alive for too long, because you keep having to feed it, and if there's no sale, there's no market for your wool, then you might as well just kill it as soon as it's fully grown for its meat. So we've got three samples, A, B and C, right? And
I tasted the biggest one first,
nice.
Which is B, and then I tasted A, and now I'm tasting C.
Okay, so I'm going to do the same thing.
I must say, Jack, very beautifully cooked, really wonderfully cooked.
Ooh, that's really tender. So I reckon A, B and C, it's lamb, mutton and then hogget.
Rosie, do you have any thoughts?
I think I would tend to agree that A is lamb. But I think that it's the other way around. B is hogget, C is mutton.
So they're in chronological order.
I think Manu's right then. Because if they're in chronological, that's too easy for it to be in chronological order.
Well, you should have trusted your gut, because I put them in chronological order.
No! I was right!
I couldn't remember them if they weren't.
That's so good.
Okay, well, we got lamb, right?
Yeah, you're very good at identifying lamb.
So I would say that A, which is lamb, was the sweetest for me. The meat is definitely sweeter, almost kind of nutty. But it also, the giveaway for me was that it was the most cooked, actually, because lamb as a younger meat is going to cook quicker than slightly older meats.
That's interesting, yeah.
Why is that?
Well, older muscles will have got more collagen woven into their structure because they've worked harder. So that just is harder to break down, like it's a protein, right? So there's just more of it. It's like a more dense structure.
Okay, so it's all that kind of knitting together with the collagen. It just needs more time to detangle and loosen.
But also all of that equals flavour.
Okay. Yeah.
Hogget is so good, though. I really like the hogget. But that was the other thing that was kind of the weird giveaway for me. Uh-huh. And the reason why I wanted to say B and C were hogget and then a mutton is that because at the moment, hogget is really fashionable.
Oh, right.
And I don't know if it's because people are suddenly wise to the sustainability issue around lamb and that hogget now is a bit cheaper, but just as good quality and, very easy to cook well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I could just see that was like a lovely, beautifully reared piece of meat, lovely cut, lovely chop. And I was like, I bet you that's hogget. This is London. That's got to be, I would eat that in a nice gastro pub. But it also tasted less sweet. It's a little bit more gamey, a little bit more musty.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mutton is definitely tougher and drier. I don't know if you noticed that. Not like super noticeable, but like a little bit different in texture for me.
Mm-hmm.
The mutton definitely tasted stronger. I don't know what that is, but just like less neutral.
Awesome.
There is a real distinct lamb flavour that is grassy, and it's because of lamb fat, the way that fat carries flavour.
It is quite a divisive meat.
Mm.
Like when you were cooking or you're about to cook these chops before we started recording, I was like, please open a window. Cooking lamb, I think, is maybe one of my least favorite smells.
Sure.
Because it is like quite gamey and like it's umami, but it's also quite sour.
Mm.
And I was looking into why that is the case. And apparently it's got something to do with lamb's branched chain fatty acids.
Yeah. Basically produced by bacteria in their rumen. some animals, as we know, cows, sheep, and deer, have actually got four stomachs.
Oh, yes. Well,
they have four stomach chambers.
Four stomach chambers.
Four stomach chambers is my nickname.
And so the bacteria is in those stomachs, and that's what flavours the fatty acids that goes into the fat.
Okay.
Basically.
And we talked about this in the cheese episode, didn't we? Because of rennet.
But basically, they have a very low odour threshold. So humans can detect them. So in beef, it's beefy, but in lamb, it's lammy. But because lamb in this country, a lot of it is grass fed. Even intensively farmed lamb is grass fed. It really carries through that grassy flavor, and it's sort of pastoral and farmy. Like I will always say when I smell lamb that's really, really lammy, I'm like, oh, it's really farmy. It really smells like I've walked into a stable.
Smells like silage.
Yeah.
But that's apparently also why mint goes so well with lamb.
Right, it cuts through.
That is all, like, the acidity in mint sauce, which obviously has a lot of like vinegar in it. But then there's also something about the chemical structure of mint. So it's got a lot of branch chain ketones, which have a like similar chemical structure to the branch chain fatty acids. And apparently in Western cooking, what we like to do is pair foods that are chemically quite similar.
Interesting.
So they complement, which isn't the same across the world. Like, apparently in Chinese cooking, it's not chemically the same. That is one of the reasons why we love pairing lamb and mint. I kept coming across this story of Elizabeth I decreeing everyone needed to eat lamb with bitter herbs as a way to discourage them from eating younger animals, to encourage them to eat older animals, which would kind of boost the wool industry of that era. Like you said, the reason why we...
So you add something disgusting to your lamb so that you don't eat it.
But then the story goes that it was really tasty because people were using mint, and that's the reason why. But there's no evidence. Like, there's no evidence.
This slaps.
And they were like, joke's on you, Queen Elizabeth. We love the lamb and the bitter herbs, actually.
She did. She made some weird laws to boost the wool industry in her era. So she decreed that on Sundays, unless you're really rich, everyone had to wear a special woolen cap. Men had to wear a special woolen cap on a Sunday.
On their heads?
On their heads.
And what specific reason for a Sunday?
It's literally just like, oh, we need to use all this wool. We want to keep the wool trade going.
You all have to buy a hat and you have to wear it on Sundays. Oh, I love this. Yeah. That is such a flex.
Talk about government
overreach. What a great idea.
I know. But yeah, there's a really lovely example at the V&A if you want to look at an Elizabethan woolly hat. They're pretty cool. I can see them there.
I'm envisioning a hat akin to, have you ever seen what a sauna hat looks like? People wear those little, that's what I'm thinking of.
I'm thinking of people in London Fields wearing those little beanies that don't cover their ears.
Yeah, the really short beanies.
True. The opposite. They are so big. I think they could come down to your chin. So is there like a objectively better meat? Like, which one is of these three?
I think it depends on your use case, really. Because ultimately, if you're buying very good quality, very highly well cared for, locally reared meat, whatever you're using it for is actually the really important thing, because lamb and its tenderness, particularly in the loin chops like these, is probably the perfect thing for a chop. Whereas maybe you'd want to use mutton or hogget and those harder work muscles in a slower cook, like a hogget shoulder or a mutton shoulder in a stew or in a soup or something like that. That will have developed much more flavour than a lamb shoulder will have. Having said that though, like, lamb shoulder is fantastic and you should all be cooking it. But yeah, I think basically, like, if you want something that's going to have lots and lots of flavour, is going to hold up to long cooking, choose an older animal. If you're going to have something that's going to be cooked quickly, you know, a nice sear, want it to eat it pink, it's going to be tender, it's going to be sweet, then I'd go for lamb.
Sorry, since you mentioned tenderness and I started singing, try a little tenderness, which is by Otis Redding. Redding like the ram. I wonder if that's where he got his name from.
Maybe. So it is time for our second lunchbox, and today that is mine. But I wanted to start with a question.
Okay.
Which country has the highest sheep to human ratio?
Oh, okay. Is this like a QI style gen egg?
A little bit of a QI
isn't,
style.
But isn't the joke that it's New Zealand, like sheep shaggers?
I think it's going to be somewhere like Bahrain.
It's not New Zealand and it's not Bahrain.
It's not Wales.
It's not Wales. It is Mongolia.
Oh.
Cool country, that.
Very cool country.
Very cool.
Very empty country.
I thought there was also going to be more horses. But anyway, that's for another episode.
There are lots of horses.
For the horse episode.
But they're using all of those horses to herd lots of animals like sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So the average sheep weighs roughly 70 to 100 kilograms. And the Mongolians eat the most lamb as well.
Oh, yes, I read this, but quite a long way.
Quite a long way. It's
70
a lot.
Wow. Kilos per person.
And then it's Bahrain at 23.4 kilograms.
So three times as much almost.
And they have that highest sheep to person ratio.
Okay, so it makes sense. Yeah.
So today it's about 7 sheep per person in the country. And in comparison, New Zealand is only about 4.5 sheep per person. Okay. But it's
pitiful, New Zealand.
Know, but it's got that reputation because back in the day, say in the 1980s, it was 22 sheep per person in New Zealand.
It
was massive.
It's justified.
But now they're focusing more on kind of reforesting land as carbon offsetting rather than than rearing sheep.
I read that. I mean, it varies largely even within the Anglosphere, because I know that Brits eat a lot more lamb than like the French do. Because when I was in my year abroad in France, they'd have, you know, lamb cutlets, lamb chops and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I remember asking for lamb mince and biggest supermarket I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like horse burgers and cow tongues. And like, you'd expect them to have lamb mince. And I asked the man, I was like, avez-vous un agneau haché? And he was like, non, c'est quoi? And so like, they hadn't heard of it. Whereas in this country, you can find lamb mince in most supermarkets, I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, in Australia, they eat 15 times as much as Americans eat. I think the real takeaway from that is Americans don't really eat lamb.
They really hate lamb.
But I think it's something to do with the beef lobby in America.
Oh,
really?
That makes sense.
Essentially. Another reason why they also wouldn't eat British beef was also because of BSE, but the beef lobby doesn't like lamb, threatening.
But in Mongolia, one of the reasons they have so many sheep is because it's a nomadic population.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are so many nomadic people in Mongolia, so about 40% of the population is still nomadic, and they rely on, like, say, sheep for their meat and dairy and, like we said, insulation. They're a really good, like, high-calorie meat for cold, really harsh environments.
Lots of fat.
Yeah, lots of fat.
Delicious, smelly fat.
The thing I looked into, which brought so much joy, was the Welsh sheep population.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like I said, it's still quite high. It's about 3 sheep per person. And England's is much lower. We have about just under half a sheep per person.
Okay.
Just under so half a sheep.
Still the sheep capital of the UK.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know about Northern Ireland and Scotland.
That's true. But they do get a lot of flack for having so many sheep. Like,
they do.
Sheep shagging. Famously associated with the Welsh. Can we just talk about sheep shagging for a minute?
Are we getting closer to your lunchbox here? trying to guess what this might be.
It'll come around. In 2020, someone emailed the Ministry of Justice under the Freedom of Information Act and asked how many convictions have been secured for illegal sexual acts with sheep and bestiality acts in general since 2007.
Wow.
In Wales or in the UK?
Divided by region,
Hold on a second. If you provide information by country, could you please specify how many in England and Wales, respectively?
Wow, what a brilliantly worded question.
Wow, this is
really working the system there. Love that.
So the MOJ emailed back, and this is all available as a Word doc you can download from the internet. They said, between 2007 and 2016, a total of 27 people have been convicted of the offence of having sexual intercourse with an animal contrary to Section 69(1) and 3 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003. Of these convictions, 25 took place in the courts of England and the remaining 2 occurred in Wales.
Whoa!
Okay.
So, well, hang on. It is a numbers game because there are more people in England than there are in Wales.
Yeah, what's
so
the
surely
ratio?
It's just a correlative to the population.
They're 10% of the population. So I think the numbers will work out pretty evenly.
You guys are now like going in on whales. Well, also, insinuating that they all, everyone says they
Listen,
are.
We know you're not sheep shaggers whales. We love you. You're amazing. And Barra Brith.
So on that note, would you like to try?
No. I'm very worried about what this might be now.
I think nothing about the stereotypes around sheep and rearing or bestiality are as they seem. And I stumbled across a dish which is really surprising because it is not a savoury dish.
Oh, you found a sweet
I found a sweet, pudding, lamb. Sweet lamb dish.
Lamb pudding.
Mm. Would you like to try it?
I'd love yeah. to, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's pretty.
Beautiful. Ooh.
So this is inspired by a dish from Iran called Koresh Mast, which is made in a particular city called Isfahan, which is south of Tehran, kind of central west of the country. And it's served as a side dish or as a dessert. And it's very similar to kind of like medieval blancmange.
Yeah, blancmange. I've done some research into like the chicken-based puddings of yore that were like chicken desserts with loads and loads of cream and chicken set like a kind of custard.
Yeah, very, very similar. It's exactly the same process, but you cook the lamb down for ages with onion, which I thought was an unusual choice.
But onion goes sweet, doesn't it?
Oh, not the way I Sweet did enough. It. The smell, it still smells really lamby. So basically, cooked down the lamb for ages with some onion, took it out, mushed it up. I didn't have the right kind of lamb, so it didn't form strands. In the actual dish, it's more like strandy.
Like filigree strands of lamb.
Nice. I didn't have that, so I just put it in a Nutribullet for a while and made like a pate.
It kind of looks like aioli.
It does.
Yeah.
And then you mix that. So you get an egg yolk, mix it with some sugar, and then you mix yogurt into that, and then you cook it and it starts to like set a bit. Oh. And then you flavour it with rose water. There's some cardamom in there, saffron. Then you add the lamb mush and then you put it in the fridge.
Okay.
What I will say is you've made a very generous portion. I think you're a bit optimistic.
You might love it.
Well,
you
it's quite hard to reduce episodes down to a teaspoon. Yeah. In fact,
okay.
Well, I might love it. Yeah.
Try and get some of the saffron, I think.
It smells like saffron.
Ooh.
I love saffron.
That's not bad.
That's actually
That's way better than
bad.
I thought it was going to be.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God for cardamom, am I right?
And Nina worried.
That's actually quite nice.
It's pretty good. I can't actually taste the lamb.
It's like just there as like a really weird meaty undertone. Mm. Like you do get it, but it's like really not strong at all.
The saffron
it's actually really not that bad. Do you know what? The protein bros should be hitting the Koresh Mast bandwagon because I bet you that's got like 80 grams of protein in it.
I like that, you know?
Yeah, it's good.
I think likes like maybe it. A step too far, but
I
don't
rose,
hate is probably where I'm at with it.
The rose water saffron element.
Oh. Mm, I love that combo.
Mm-hmm.
The spicing is beautiful, Manu.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for introducing that to me. I would never have tried that if you hadn't brought it.
I would love to try the proper version of this because butchered this in not a good way. So, thank you, Koresh Mast recipe from Hamish Shafari.
We mentioned in the intro the oldest recipe ever found.
Mm.
It's for a lamb stew.
Ooh.
And it was inscribed on a tablet in ancient Babylon, which is roughly equivalent to modern day Iraq, but obviously the borders have changed. And it was inscribed into a tablet in cuneiform, the world's first written language. This is, a direct translation. Meat is used. You prepare water. You add fine-grained salt, dried barley cakes, onion, Persian shallot, and milk.
Hmm.
You crush and add leek and garlic. And we theorise that it was lamb because that, you know, as we mentioned, common to the Fertile Crescent. A team at Yale University created this lamb stew and, they said it was okay.
Nice.
I mean, it sounds pretty standard to me, apart from the barley cakes, which I don't know what they are, but...
kind of in the kind of history of weird stuff that historians have made and eaten and archaeologists have unearthed, that is a pretty decent. Yeah,
it's not husky dog, you know, when they were accidentally eating those instead of what they thought was woolly mammoth.
Mm-hmm. Another quirk of history. Did you come across the vegetable lamb of Tartary?
I did.
No.
So there's this odd myth in Western Europe in the Middle Ages. Mm. So we're talking medieval period. First reference was from 436 Common mm-hmm. Era. And I think it was kind of debunked in the 1700s. So basically there's this idea that in the East, and I'm doing inverted commas mm-hmm. here, so east of Western Europe, basically, in a land they called Tartary, which is roughly equivalent to an enormous area which covers bits of Western China, bits of Southern Russia, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, mm-hmm. and basically Central Asia. Mm-hmm. People would go and visit and they'd come back and tell stories of this plant, which these big seed pods that were as big as melons, and they would burst forth and woolly lambs would come out.
Wow.
And there are variants on the story. Claude Duret of Moulins, who wrote in his Histoire admirable des plantes in 1605, basically a history of plants, he referred to a Jewish traveller who in 436 sees what they called a jedua, which is basically a variant where there's one umbilical cord attached to the lamb, which is the plant stem. And the lamb would basically eat, like one of those lawnmowers that's attached to a tether, eat as far as it could reach. And then when it ran out of food, it would just die. Oh. And weirdly, like the only carnivore that was attracted to it was a wolf. Uh-huh. So tigers would just pass it by. And this myth kind of perpetuated for 500 years. And no one could really disprove it because the people going to these parts of the world would come back and no one could say any different. Mm. And I think it might have been a bit conflated with the idea of cotton because people were talking about like, the locals of Tartary would sort of weave this vegetable wool into cloth. And so it's kind of like, and even the modern German for cotton is Baumwolle, which means tree wool. Literally. Mm. So that, like, if you can imagine if you grew up in a country where the only fabric for making clothes was wool from a lamb, that the idea of getting wool from a plant would be like a bit alien. Anyway, it was known as the vegetable lamb of Tartary. And there was an 1887 text that I read where the guy basically debunked it and said, look, these myths are all myths. We've visited and no one's ever reported similar in the last 200 years. And it's all a load of bollocks. And probably basically people saw cotton plants and got confused.
Yeah. Well, also, it's just physically, scientifically impossible, isn't it?
Exactly.
For a lamb to be birthed from a pod.
I mean, that's actually not true.
What?
So, not a plant pod, but in 2017, researchers from the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia managed to bring preterm lambs in pods, so like plastic fake wombs.
Like an artificial womb.
But not like a Jurassic Park style
that's
plant.
Very true. Because one of the most dangerous things about looking after preterm babies is having them out of the womb breathing oxygen when they're not ready for air. Mm. So this showed a way to kind of help preterm. I mean, hopefully they can use it on humans.
Mimic utero, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Like being in utero.
Mm-hmm. Very super
cool.
I also love the oldest viable sperm ever came from a ram as
really?
Well. Yeah, so in 1968, a bunch of researchers at the University of Sydney froze some sperm. And then nearly 50 years later, they managed to impregnate 34 ewes with this sperm.
What a time capsule. Imagine if the Blue Peter team had buried some ram sperm in the Blue Peter garden.
It was really cool because they brought back extinct characteristics that have been in this ram. So some sheep used to be a lot more like foldy because it made more wool.
Yeah.
As in, the more skin, the more floof. But those are parasites and stuff used to get caught in the fold, so they bred it out. But in these old new sheep, it was back. Very wrinkly babies.
Crazy.
Wow. Yeah. Time for our final lunchbox today, and that is yours, Rosie.
I have brought with me a doner kebab, a lamb doner.
It smells beautiful.
Yeah. I'm so glad you think so.
It's also the wrong time of day to be smelling this.
Yes. Let's just talk about what a doner kebab is first. So,
okay, while we're munching.
A doner kebab
so good.
Is from Turkey. It is, in this case, we see shaved meat, minced meat, that was cooked on a revolving vertical spit.
Okay.
And that is served, in this case, with salad, pickles, a couple of different sauces, and it is served on top of chips. You will also see it served in bread. In Turkey, it's actually not really how it comes at all. So in Turkey, you would probably see a proper doner kebab served on a plate, often over rice or a pilaf, sometimes fried potatoes or chips. It can also be wrapped in a thin bread, like which is more like a lavash bread, okay, not the bread that we get in this country in kebab shops, I'm which is way it. Thicker. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's basically a mix of lamb and beef, but okay, it's historically was just lamb. Mm-hmm. You can have two different types of doner kebab. So you can have a one which is made with sliced meat, mm, and one that's made with minced meat. Mm. So do you know what I'm saying, what the difference looks like? So the sliced meat doners are big vertical spits with a conical meat mass. And it's basically lots and lots of layers of thinly sliced meat stacked really tightly together. Mm-hmm. It's all marinated and it's cooked on the spit and then it's shaved off with a really clever electric knife. I mean, in Turkey as well, actually, they just use really good sharp knives. They're so skilled, the men who make these. Yeah, they're literally just like whoosh. Wow. But so you'll see it in a kebab shop on your local high street because they are very, very popular in this country.
Known perhaps a bit dismissively as an elephant leg because it does look a bit like an elephant's leg.
Kinda
have you
does.
Never come across that?
No, I hadn't.
It's the homing beacon for all drunk people across the UK.
Yeah. So the sliced meat doners tend to be less popular in this country because they're just harder to make in mass. Whereas the minced meat doners are very popular. This one is minced. Mm. So
it's very popular with me.
Yeah. Are you enjoying that?
Yes, thank you.
So it's basically
you keep talking,
like,
I was going to say, we're doing some really good listening.
Yeah. The difficulty with the minced meat doner is that very often, certainly in this country now, the mixture that you will encounter is a bit of a mystery, as it were. And there are things like rusk and starches and stuff like to keep it moist and keep it together.
That's why fish and chip sausages are so good.
Rusk.
Rusk is key.
Rusk.
Is rusk just old bread?
Bready,
yeah, but it's not even bread. It's like almost kind of like biscuit. So the meat typically was lamb, but as I said, you will very often see a blend of lamb and beef now. Yeah. And actually, when I bought this, I said a lamb doner, and then I looked at the menu and it said meat doner.
Uh-oh.
So I was like,
mystery meat.
When it's a sliced meat doner, that is known as a yaprak or a leaf doner. Mm-hmm. And when it's a minced meat doner, that's known as a kaima lamb doner. So a kaima is basically, it's way easier to get a uniform strip of meat because you don't have, you know, uneven pieces of flattened meat. No. Mm-hmm. Something that I found out that I thought was super interesting. So I was looking at why lamb is good for kebab. Like, what is it about lamb that is so good for spit roasting, fire roasting? Mm. And actually, there is a prized type of sheep breed in Arab countries in the Middle East called a fat tail sheep.
Ooh.
Have you heard of this?
I think I have.
So basically, these sheep grow really fat tails. That is on a sheep's tail has a lower melting point than all the other lamb fat in the lamb body and lots of other animal fats.
And would that be an evolutionarily advantage?
Well, it's not really clear how this has chemically happened. Mm. There is a theory that it's because the tail itself is exposed to colder temperatures. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the meat has a lower melting point. Like,
then
I don't
it's more
know.
Fat. I need to,
but it's basically akin to lamb fat. When it's on the cap of a chop, for example, that we saw earlier, is very similar to beef fat. It's it's minceable, it's solid when it's cold, and it looks like beef fat, and it's known as tallow. Mm-hmm. Whereas lamb tail fat, which is really prized in Middle Eastern cooking and is used really, really widely, and is even used to like confit lamb meat and stuff like that, is a lot more closer to almost like butter in texture or bacon fat. Like it's kind of gooey and ooey and smooth and lovely. Thin slices of lamb tail fat is used in traditional Turkish doner. We will not see that in this country because we are cheap bastards. Yeah. But in Turkish doner, in very good kebab shops across the country, that is what you will find. I just thought that was so interesting that there's literally a chemical benefit to using lamb fat in doner. Anyway, the real reason why I wanted to talk about doner kebabs today is because of the kebab wars, which I don't know if you're aware, but doner kebab...
When's the kebab draft? Sort of,
doner kebab has a sort of second home in Berlin, Germany, yes. Because post-war, a massive Turkish migration happened to Europe, and a lot of Turkish people settled in Germany. And, you know, as is often the way with large-scale immigration, food service was a great place for immigrants to start working. And so they all set up Turkish kebab shops and they started making doner kebabs. And the doner kebab that we see in the UK and in Europe is a lot closer to German doner kebab than it is to Turkish doner kebab.
Okay. Why is that?
I think it just other Turkish immigrants living in Europe... Mm-hmm. You know, friends and family, you know, living in various different countries are like, oh, we'll do a doner your way. And it's basically spread. So seeing a kebab where there's doner meat, there's loads of pickles, sauces, salads, different toppings. That is not very Turkish. That's way more German.
Oh, so it's like Chinese food in America.
A little bit.
Like
there's always a little bit of, you know.
Evolutionarily, it's almost swirling around. Its own species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Turkish government... were not pleased about that. They wanted to protect the historical integrity of the doner. So have we spoken, I'm sure we have, about the traditional specialty guaranteed TSG label that's given by the European Union to different foods?
Protected geographical
Yeah, we call them PGIs and DOCs.
Exactly. And so and TSG is another term for it. So we're talking about things like Parmesan, champagne, you know, like Neapolitan pizza can't be called Neapolitan pizza if it's not made in a certain way.
You know, Newcastle Brown Ale were the first brand to actually request not to have a PGI.
Really?
Because they started making it not in the northeast
because it was cheaper.
Right.
And then you couldn't call it Newcastle Brown because it's...
Wait, so had they been given one and they were actually, we don't want it.
So.
Other examples, feta, roquefort. And it doesn't necessarily always mean geographical, but it can mean method. Exactly. For example, champagne. So the International Doner Federation, UDAFED, made an application in 2022 to register doner as a traditional specialty guaranteed, a TSG product within the EU. And it basically aimed to strictly define the production, covering meat types, thickness, that kind of stuff, ingredients.
Got it.
And this is really, really bad news for German doner kebab sellers.
Because they're doing it differently.
They are doing a roaring trade of doner kebab.
And they wouldn't be able to call it doner.
What?
And there are lots of differences in German doner kebab in particular, and stuff we wouldn't even see here. Like in Germany, for example, they will often have a veal doner or turkey.
Oh, wow, how fitting.
And obviously sauces, different salads, pita bread sandwich, vibes, like, you know... There was lots of basically riffs that German doner kebab sellers and doner kebab sellers in the UK and in Ireland and in anywhere else you will find doner kebab in Europe were doing that are not strictly Turkish. So there was significant opposition to this bid, primarily from Germany, but also Germany's friends, because it would make a massive impact on popular local diverse kebab styles. And
it kind of restricts innovation in some ways, doesn't it?
Well, it's, and it's also like, you know, I can see both sides. You know, it's doner kebab is obviously a really special thing to the to Turkey. And the history of doner kebab is not really that well defined. And there are some people who will argue it. There isn't sort of like it's not one thing. It's inherently a very Turkish dish, but it was brought to Germany by Turkish people and is still mostly being made by Turkish German people. So it kind of feels a bit unfair to take their food away from them in the country they live in as well. It is quite a hard, undefinable dish in terms of like a historical moment that it was invented. As Turkish culinary historian Mary Isin writes, it's a history with many huge gaps. There is no writing with the words doner kebab in until 1908, and that's an Ottoman source. But there are depictions of a kebab or a doner kebab roasting on a horizontal spit, and those are from the 17th century in two little paintings. there's not very much else, but it's weird because suddenly in the 19th century, tourists who were traveling to Turkey were talking about doner kebab as if it was really common and as if everyone knew what it was. Mm. And that's what they'd seen. But there was just no real mention of it in Turkish and Ottoman texts.
Well, maybe it's a bit like, maybe it was just the trendy food at the time. It's a bit like if Martians came down and saw we were all drinking matcha and they were like, this is so important to Earth culture.
I think it was next year, we're like, matcha's over.
Now it's ubiquitous.
That it didn't even get mentioned because it didn't occur to people to mention it. It was very popular for basically as an outdoor food. It was a picnic food. The word doner comes from the Turkish word donmek, meaning turning, which obviously you will see in the vertical spit.
Very nice.
And basically the spit was originally horizontal, but in the 19th century, kebab restaurants in Istanbul started to use vertical spits mainly for space-saving purposes, but also because actually it means the meat self-bastes. The reason why a doner kebab is shaped like that...
Oh, it tapers.
...is because the fatter top end has more juice and that's dripping down into the gradually thinner bottom, self-basting the meat as it cooks.
I just thought it was the way they cut it. I was like, it must be, I don't know why that would be more useful. But
well, some people do it straight, but a lot of times you'll see it then.
I just thought it was a literal elephant's leg.
There is one clue as to how it might have evolved, which I thought was amazing as a, like, anecdote. Basically, it came from an account written in 1433 by Bertrandon de la Broquière. He was a French traveller. Don't mind my French. He describes meeting a group of Turkish travellers in Anatolia who invited him to share their spit roast sheep. And he says, instead of waiting for the whole sheep to cook through, they are cutting slices off the outside, which of course makes a lot of sense. You're not going to wait for 4 hours before a whole sheep is cooked, right? They're doing kebabbery on a whole roasting animal.
Plus you can get the Maillard reaction on the whole thing because the outside will crisp up as the inside won't.
The beauty is like the more layers you expose, another crispy layer, another soft layer, another crispy layer, another soft layer. And actually I watched a few TikToks and YouTube videos of kebabs in Istanbul. So I've never been to Istanbul and I'm absolutely desperate to go. When you see leaf doner, so the ones that I describe where the meat is strips, the meat is very often quite rare as they're cutting down the doner. And they finish cooking the strips on an open grill. So they'll cut a strip of meat off, put it on a piece of lavash or on a skewer, finish cooking it and then serve it.
Did you hear about the Ottoman polymath in the 1500s?
No.
So you know the Industrial Revolution. Let me tell to you about that. That was basically built on steam. So it was the catalyst for building the modern world as we know it, the invention of factories and steam trains and mining. It sort of started in the 1750s and it's still going, basically. But that all relied on the invention of the steam engine. 250 years earlier, there's a man in the Ottoman Empire called Taki ad-Din Muhammad ibn Maruf, who invented a steam turbine, but all he used it for, what he mostly is famous for using it for, is making a spit that would automatically turn. So he basically invented the Industrial Revolution and just didn't, was like, hey, I can make my meat without having to touch it. I can make my kebabs, so I'll leave it at that.
That is stunning.
Classic.
I mean, he did lots of other things with his life, but that's one thing pretty... Literal revolution.
Literal revolution.
For this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy, you can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
Yes, and you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, and questions by emailing us. lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any parting lammy recipes for us?
Can I give you a recommendation for a recipe that's not my own for once? If you like this podcast, then you should definitely subscribe to the Substack newsletter called Vittles. It's a fantastic publication, probably the best online food magazine in the world, I would say. Very non-biased. I don't write for it, I promise. Anyway, in a recent post, they shared a recipe from Kurdish food writer Melek Erdal of a lamb soup. She writes a really wonderful story about how this soup was made for her by another chef and the story of her testing the recipe to get it right. And it's just a lovely piece of food writing and it also sounds delicious. So I would recommend you find that.
Great.
We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox MB was hosted by Jack Chambers, Rosie McKean, and me, Manu Onrio. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.